Time and place set for oral argument in the case of Hepworth versus Hepworth, docket number 48478. Here on behalf of the appellant is Mr. Bevis. On behalf of the respondent is Mr. Sanderson. Mr. Bevis, are you prepared to give argument?
I am, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Thank you. May it please the court, may it please counsel. This appeal involves the issue of what interest rate judgment or prejudgment applies to the time period from when Mr. Hepworth stole and sold Ms. Evans' stock until the time that she obtained a money judgment related to the same. As your honors are aware, the divorce decree was entered in this case in October of 2015, and per the same, Ms. Evans was awarded and was the owner of one half of the C&D purchase shares in Red Top Limited Holdings. Attached to the decree was a written notarized agreement regarding the ownership of those shares. Unbeknownst to Ms. Evans, Mr. Hepworth stole and sold those shares and hid the proceeds. In doing so, he not only deprived her of her shares, but stole from her other rights that she had related to those shares, such as her right to negotiate for a higher price in the event of an offer of sale, or the right to decide not to sell those shares. Ms. Evans was awarded stock per the decree, not money. And that difference is significant because both the magistrate and the district court's decisions were that Amy's claim was money due on a judgment, in this case, the judgment being the divorce decree, and therefore that she would be limited to judgment interest only. The effect of the same is that now in every post-divorce enforcement action, the relief would be limited to judgment interest if the facts of the same brought by a claim, even if the facts are the same, bring the claim within what we would call the prejudgment interest realm. It's our position that both the magistrate and the district court erred in the determination that Ms. Evans' claim was money due on the decree or the judgment. And that error can be found by looking at the facts and the clear language of the decree and the applicable statute in this case, Idaho Code 2811-104, subsections 1 and subsections 2. No money was due to Ms. Evans per the decree. Stocks were due. At the time that Mr. Hepworth stole and sold her property, Ms. Evans could not garnish, she could not levy, she could not execute on the decree because the decree was not for money. It was not specific as to what it is that she was owed or when it was owed. The claim had not been adjudicated with respect to what she was owed. Ms. Evans then had to obtain a money judgment and adjudicate that contested claim before the money then became due to her. I think guidance can also be found by looking at the definition of the term judgment. A judgment is a separate document that states the relief to which a party is entitled. The relief that Amy, my client, Ms. Evans, had per the decree was for stock. The relief that she had per the money judgments was money. Money was only due once she obtained the money judgments. Prior to that, it would be prejudgment. Therefore, we believe that the court erred in ignoring the clear language of the decree that she was awarded stock and ignored the clear language of the money judgments in its application of the facts to the language of the statute. Now, going back in time just a little bit, the magistrate court's reasonings in regards to the fact that it was money due on a judgment was largely based on a dissenting opinion of Justice Walters in the Worthington case, which was that this decree was the one true judgment and everything thereafter would be post-judgment. Consider also, if you would, that the magistrate court, as part of her reliance on that dissenting opinion, even went so far in the order on interest on judgment to call these money judgments that Ms. Evans obtained something other than money judgments. She called them post-judgment orders, and we believe that is error. They were not post-judgment orders, they were money judgments. They were an adjudication of Amy's claim to a money amount that was owed to her. Now, despite Ms. Evans' cross-appeal challenging the magistrate's strong reliance on the dissent in Worthington, the district court did not largely address the same. Yet, consistent with that dissent, the district court in effect determined that the decree was the one true judgment and therefore statutory interest or judgment interest would apply. And that begs the question, if the decree was the one true judgment and money was due on that judgment, then why would she need to go get another judgment? The answer is that the claims were different. One was for stock and one was for money. Next, while the magistrate court relied on the dissent in Worthington, and arguably so did the district court, the majority in Worthington found that pre-judgment and post-judgment interests would be allowed on the same claim in appropriate circumstances. In looking at the use of the word claim, the claim here was for stock, and then it changed when the stock was sold, and it was then for money. Therefore, per the majority in Worthington, prejudgment interest would be allowed in appropriate circumstances. And I think when looking at the facts of this case, i.e. Mr. Hepworth's conduct, appropriate circumstances certainly do exist. Now, I'm always nervous to say that an issue such as one like this has not been squarely addressed in other cases, but I kind of believe that's true. I know someone will correct me if I'm wrong, but both the district court and the magistrate court look to these other family law cases for guidance. But those cases are largely outlier cases or did not squarely address prejudgment interest. The district court stated, as regards to Ms. Evans' claims, like many other family law judgments, some money may be due at some future date. That is not this case. Money was not due at some future date per the decree of divorce. Stocks were due, at least until such time as Mr. Hepworth sold Ms. Evans' assets. This case is different than child support cases where child support is specific and set forth in a judgment. That is money due on a judgment. This is different than alimony where alimony amount is specific and known and set forth in a judgment. That is money due in judgment. This is different than equalization payments, the amount which is specific and known. That is money due on judgment. This was not money that was due on the decree. This was theft and sale of an asset and deprivation of Ms. Evans' rights to her property. I would note that none of the cases cited by the district court or the magistrate, with the exception of maybe Worthington and an outlier issue in Swope, address this prejudgment interest issue. And maybe it's that it's never really been brought up in the context with the divorce because it seems so simple to say that, well, it's post-divorce, and so it's got to be limited to judgment interest. But I think in looking at the child support cases and the alimony cases and the equalization cases, the difference on those is the amount is specific and known. And in this case, it's not known until such time as Mr. Hepworth sells the stock. But I think the one that has to be addressed, obviously, is Swope. And Swope did not involve a situation here where the husband and Swope sold the bonds and stole the proceeds. And importantly, in Swope, there was no argument for prejudgment interest related to the income on the bonds that husband had retained. And if you look closely at Swope, the court indicated that the interest due on the bonds, and I'll quote, can be viewed as money due on judgment. This is a can and not a shall. If the one true judgment concept from Worthington is correct, then it would be a shall. The facts of this case are outside of Swope. In Swope, wife got the bonds, but not the interest. In this case, Miss Evans did not get her stock because it was stolen from her. And in doing so—
Could I interrupt you for a minute there?
Yeah, absolutely.
Am I understanding your argument that the words, the judgment under subsection 2 refer to a judgment in which there is a readily ascertainable money amount?
I'm, Your Honor, and I apologize for this. In subsection 2 of what?
Of the statute, I'm sorry, of the statute.
I'm sorry, thanks.
Money due on the judgment. Are the words the judgment related to a judgment that has a readily ascertainable dollar amount, like a child support amount or an alimony amount?
Well, in subsection 2, the legal rate of interest on money due on the judgment of any competent court or tribunal shall be the interest rate of 5%. So I guess my short answer to your question is yes, it applies to a judgment in which a dollar amount is owed.
Okay, thank you.
So kind of finishing up with this idea of Swope. So in Swope, the bonds were not stolen by the husband. Now, the husband improperly retained what would be the interest payments on the bonds, but wife ultimately received those bonds. In this case, by selling the stock, Miss Evans' rights to receive something were then dictated or limited by Mr. Hepworth. And so we're not just talking about the sale of an asset and the receipt of funds. We're talking about his deprivation of what is and were her property rights to an asset that she bargained for as part of a divorce. And in this case, and I noted this in my brief, I think it was interesting that the magistrate judge talked about equitable principles with respect to her decision on judgment interest. I think equitable principles apply more in pre-judgment interest cases because judgment interest is statutory in nature and is awarded as a matter of right on the judgment of a court, whereas pre-judgment interest requires a little bit more of discretionary findings. And so in this situation, we believe, based on the consideration of equitable principles and the fact that even the district court noted that if the district court was wrong and the magistrate was wrong, the prejudgment interest would be applicable. And we believe that it should have been awarded and that in limiting Ms. Evans' rights to the stock per the decree as related to money due on judgment was an error in not only the law, but the application of the facts to law. Now, one of the previous oral arguments that I've done in the court, I was asked a question about the standard of review. And so I do want to cover that because it appears, and I may be wrong on this, but the Herr case came out on Friday from the Supreme Court. And it states that this court must focus on the findings and conclusions made by the magistrate court and determine whether they were supported by the evidence and consistent with the law. And in my opinion, and I argue you today, that the decisions of the magistrate and the district court were not supported by the facts because this was not money due on judgment. And I do not believe that the law of the state of Idaho is such that all post-divorce claims should be limited to judgment interest if the claim simply arises as part of a divorce. It is the entry of a money judgment that applies to the judgment interest. And there is not a judgment on which money was due, then it would be pre-judgment interest. Okay. Lastly, we request a reversal and remand with instructions to award prejudgment interest on Ms. Evans' claims from the time that Mr. Hepworth sold the stock until Ms. Evans received the money judgment because she would be entitled to prejudgment interest during that time period. As to the issue of attorney's fees, we are here because of Mr. Hepworth's conduct, his violation, his theft, and his concealment of the proceeds of these stocks that he sold, this property of my client that he sold. And that conduct clearly is frivolous and unreasonable. And my client should be made whole by an award of attorney's fees. Further, and I think this is an important fact when looking at the attorney fee award, please do not forget the fact that it was Mr. Hepworth who appealed the magistrate's decision, claiming error in the decision to award interest back to the time that the stock was sold, because at that time, money was not due because there was not a money judgment. Now on appeal, he switched his position, and I see that as unreasonable. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bevis. Mr. Sanderson, any reply?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. May it please the court and counsel. In my dealings with Mr. Bevis, it's always a pleasure to watch him argue and construct his arguments, and I appreciate the opportunity I have to learn from him. However, we believe that this court should uphold and affirm the district court's ruling that Ms. Evans is entitled to statutory interest pursuant to 28-22-1042, and that the award of attorney's fees is not appropriate. Now, Mr. Bevis touched on this slightly, and I think this all comes to the standard of review that's held in Neustadt versus, I'm going to slaughter this, Colafranceschi, and that's Idaho 167 Idaho 214. This court has held that the Supreme Court reviews the magistrate court's record to determine whether there is substantial and competent evidence to support the magistrate's findings of fact and whether the magistrate's conclusions of law follow from those findings. If those findings are supported and the conclusions follow therefrom, and if the district court affirmed the magistrate's decision, we affirm the district court's decision as a matter of procedure. It's clear that the district court found that there was substantial and incompetent evidence. We would defer to the factual and procedural background as it's outlined in the district court's opinion on appeal, as it is not quite as emotional as the one that has been presented to us today. The magistrate court found that there was a divorce decree entered on October 29th, 2015, that the judgment in this case was the decree, and that was the only one true judgment. And the decree was based on the stipulation of the parties. The stipulation of the parties awarded Ms. Evans a one-half share, or a one-half of the shares in Red Top Holdings Limited. May it also be noted that these shares weren't transferable, so that Ms. Evans could take them and cash them out themselves. They were only to be held by Mr. Hepworth. Mr. Hepworth was, according to the stipulation, to hold those in trust and inform Ms. Evans when he sold them. I don't think that there is an implied right of negotiating the sale amount or anything in there. The language of the stipulation says that he was to inform her. He failed in that, and that is clear from the findings of the magistrate court and the district court. He didn't notify Ms. Evans of the sale of the shares. He received the funds from those shares on November 3rd, 2017. At that time, they were valued at $897,833.05. And another amount was held in escrow to cover other expenses, at which time Mr. Hepworth received $66,488.06, which Ms. Evans was entitled to half of it. And that occurred on the 5th of November, 2018. The court's conclusions of law are consistent with the law. And I think where we have our dispute here is whether this is pre-judgment interest or statutory interest. And I think the court made a fine analysis in its review of Idaho Code 2822-1042, of Hunsaker v. Hunsaker, of Krebs v. Krebs, where this was an occasion where the husband occupied the marital property and received a benefit of it. Yet still, after it sold, the court decided that the statutory interest was applicable. And in Swope versus Swope, as Mr. Bevis touched on, which was a case involving statutory interest on the bonds. My understanding as why prejudgment interest is not appropriate in this case is under Idaho Code 2822-104. You can interpret that as all the definitions of when you can have this prejudgment interest is summed up as defining when there is a sum certain in that order or in that contract or whatever the instrument is, and it's easy to calculate. There was not a sum certain in this case until November of 2017, when Mr. Hepworth sold those shares. And the magistrate court appropriately related back that interest back to the time of the decree and the order. As such, and I guess Mr. Bevis is calling this as disingenuous, but after going through the appeal process, which, you know, the district court felt was not brought frivolously or unreasonably or without foundation, we decided to appeal it because there was a question of what was the judgment. And the district court clarified that and followed the reasoning of the magistrate court as to what the judgment was. Attorney's fees are not appropriate. Mr. Bevis wants to bring up the conduct of the past as being appropriate, but the case law, as in Thomas v. Madsen, that's 142 Idaho 635, is that it's appropriate when the appeal is brought appeal is brought or defended frivolously, unreasonably, or without foundation. Now, the district court found that the arguments presented and the reasoning were not unreasonable in this case, and therefore attorney's fees were not justified. In conclusion, we ask that this court uphold the district court's decision and affirm that Ms. Evans is entitled to statutory interest as outlined in the original decision, and that the award of attorney's fees is not appropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Sanderson.
Thank you.
Mr. Bevis, any reply?
No, Your Honor. Thank you for your time.
All right. With that, the court appreciates the briefing and argument in this case. The case has now been fully submitted and an opinion will issue in due course. Court will be in recess until November 18th. Thank you.
Thank you.